The man that police now think killed 6-year-old Aiden Pates back in 1979 has reportedly been placed on a suicide watch. Pedro Hernandez is expected to be arraigned this afternoon on second-degree murder charges on this, the anniversary of Aiden Pates' disappearance 33 years ago today, after he was allowed to walk to the bus stop for the first time by himself. In fact, this is National Missing Children's Day, named in Aiden's honor by President Reagan. The suspect, Pedro Hernandez, was a teenage stock boy in a bodega in Aiden's neighborhood, who'd reportedly told family members years ago that he'd killed a child. But it wasn't until police very publicly reopened this case, digging up a basement in Pates' old neighborhood last month, that a relative tipped off police. Police now say Hernandez has confessed to luring Aiden Pates into the store, strangling him, and putting his body out with the trash. Dean Memminger is a criminal justice reporter for New York One News, that city's 24-hour news channel. Dean, quite something. Why do police think Hernandez is different from others who've claimed to be involved in this case?
Well, one of the issues is that he had spoken to family members and church members over the years, confessing to them that he had killed a child in New York City, that he had did something horrible. So he did tell other family members this, according to the police department, and may have told a family member that he did something bad back as far as 1981.
Right, just a couple years after. Well, your station spoke with someone who remembered Hernandez from that neighborhood in 1979. Let's listen.
He was not there, if you know what I mean. There was something about him you could not be friends with him.
But the New York Times is reporting that people in his neighborhood now in New Jersey know Pedro Hernandez as a Pentecostal. They can't believe this about him. What more do we know about him?
Well, let me bring you up to speed because this is continuing to develop. We know there is a scheduled arraignment later this afternoon, but right now he is at Bellevue Hospital in Manhattan. That's a city-run hospital, but it has a huge psychiatric ward. So he is receiving some sort of psychiatric evaluation just hours before his arraignment.
Right.
He was taken there. So well, that could be an issue for the prosecution here, where he has to be evaluated before, or perhaps even on some sort of suicide watch, as some media outlets are reporting.
Right.
So
well,
that's
but
the situation with him currently.
But there are other questions as well. His name was not on a list of suspects back in 79, but it was in a detective's report as someone who worked in that bodega, so there are questions as to why he wasn't interviewed then. And then there's Jorge Ramos. Now, this is the friend of a woman who was hired to walk Aiden Pates home from school. He served prison time in Pennsylvania. In 2004, a judge found Ramos liable for Aiden Pates' death. That led to a civil suit, although he's never confessed. Now, we're going to hear more about Ramos in a moment. But we, of course, were wondering if perhaps Jorge Ramos and this new suspect, Pedro Hernandez, were in any way connected. And the Daily News is quoting a former detective in this case who's wondering that as well. Are you hearing about any possible connection?
Well, I was in the press conference with the police commissioner last night. He said at this point the investigation continues and that they don't know if there is a connection, but they're trying to speak to or re-interview as many people as possible, even trying to find out from old store workers at that bodega on the corner of West Broadway and Prince Street if they remember anything weird about the day Eitan went missing. So they are continuing to investigate. And right now, as we speak, the crime scene unit for New York City Police, they arrived to that location where the bodega used to be. It is now an eyeglass store. But police are back on the scene, perhaps trying to get into that store and perhaps trying to go into the basement to look for any sort of evidence. As you mentioned earlier, a month ago, the NYPD and FBI, they dug up another basement in the area looking for evidence, and all of the media hype over that dig led to a tipster calling into police about Pedro Hernandez.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, New York City Police Commissioner Kelly says that Pedro Hernandez, in his talks with police, has said specific things about the case. We'll, of course, hear more about this as reporting goes on today. Dean Memminger, a criminal justice reporter for New York One News there in New York City. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's bring in Lisa Cohen now. She's been covering this story for 22 years, starting as a fledgling producer at ABC News in 1990. Her 2009 book is entitled After Eitan, The Missing Child Case That Held America Captive. And she joins us now from the NPR studios in New York. Lisa, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are after being so steeped in this case for decades. And I imagine, you know, first of all, you're thinking about the parents.
Well, I am, and I'm also thinking about sort of the whiplash effect of this news, because I know how I'm feeling about it, which is this comes seemingly out of nowhere, and I know that this isn't something that they've had any time to digest at all.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about what you learned about the life they lived after Eitan left. You know, we've been hearing never changed their phone number, but also kept detailed notes.
When the case first occurred, the New York Police Department told them that they had to write down every phone call that came in, a number and contents. And so they started doing that, and it became a habit, and they do it today. So 33 years of notebooks filled with every incoming call and every way in which this could possibly be something to follow up on.
And they got wacky calls. I mean, this must have just ripped open the wound every time the phone rang.
Oh, I mean, when I started to write the book, there was a woman in Florida who was writing to Stan Pates, Eitan's father, to say that she was in the midst of a divorce from somebody and he had no photos of himself before the age of 6, and she wanted him to send a hairbrush with his hair so that they could have a DNA tested because she was convinced that she had been married to Eitan Pates. I mean, people would call from drunken parties to say, we're coming over to search the place. We know he's there. People would call and pretend to be Eitan. People would call in and confess, you know, or show up at their house to confess. I mean, this is one of hundreds of jarring and painful moments in this case.
Well, meanwhile, I'm sure you're also thinking of the detectives and the other suspects. Let's remind people who Jose Ramos was. In 1982, he was accused of trying to lure children. Police found pictures of young boys in his things. He reportedly also knew a woman who was hired to walk the children, the Page children, from school. But nothing panned out with him. And then he resurfaced in 1988 in Pennsylvania, serving time on molestation. And police obviously think he's the guy. You start following a U.S. attorney, Stuart Grabois, who was so interested in talking to Jose Ramos that he had himself sworn in as a deputy prosecutor in Pennsylvania. Tell us more about following him.
He got the case in the mid-80s. It was already several years old. And he went back, as every generation of investigators have done, and started looking at everything fresh. So, I mean, Jose Ramos was one of the many, many leads that he followed to the end and back. He went to Israel because there were some rumors that Eitan had been spirited away to Israel and, you know, tromped from kibbutz to check on little boys named Eitan Pates. He went out to Ohio. There was a boy out there that they had some reason to believe could have been Eitan. He pursued Jose Ramos, and Ramos was in a prison in Pennsylvania, and he was serving a short molestation charge. Stuart Grabois brought him for questioning to his office in New York, at which point Ramos actually said, I took a boy that day, and I'm 90% sure that boy was Eitan Pates. I took him to my apartment. I tried to have sex with him. He protested, and I let him go, at which point he lawyered up. And Grabois then pursued him to Pennsylvania, found another case that had been outstanding of molestation, and was able to basically get the case back on the docket, prosecute him, and have him sentenced to 20 years for that other molestation case. So he's pursued him everywhere and continues to believe that Jose Ramos is, in fact, the person who took and killed Eitan.
And as we said, in 2004, a judge found Ramos liable for Eitan's death in a wrongful death civil lawsuit. So this is all going to be parsed out. But meanwhile, tell us more about the other people that investigators had to deal with over the past decades. You know, Grabois would corner people at cocktail parties if he thought they had something new, but then people would corner him too.
Yeah, I mean, there were people, there was an incredible story in the book about a medium who was sent to him by a very credible source who had had all kinds of visions, and she led Gravois and other and NYPD detectives around Manhattan and brought them to a remote location in northern Manhattan where they there was a cross with a sweater on it. There was a sort of a writing on a rock that said, you know, EP. And they ended up sending NYPD divers into the waters off the coast there. And,
By the way, I reread that chapter in your book. It's just chilling, you know, scrambling down this riverbank by the Hudson, you know, and there's this cross with the tattered remnants of a child's sweater, just teddy bears, you know, just awful, just an awful sort of hellish place. What did they think was happening there?
Well, I have to say, he is one of the most skeptical people that I know. So it's not as though he was, I mean, he dealt with mediums and psychics in the past and had always been very, very skeptical. But he thought, you know, I can't afford to just turn away. There's always a chance that she perhaps is part of this and had something to do with this kidnapping. And so they followed her down to this river's edge, and she had information she couldn't possibly have had unless she either had some kind of psychic ability or she was part of it. And so they ended up digging down there and never found anything. But ultimately, that was actually the lead that kind of tripped somebody's brain to check on some things and brought Jose Ramos's name to the forefront.
It just really is quite something. The hours logged, the time spent, the heartbreak, you know, all the people involved. It's just incredible. Anna Quinlan once wrote that Aiden Pates was the most famous missing child since the Lindbergh baby. You write about hearing a conversation between two moms in Central Park in 2004. What was that exchange?
Oh, it was actually, they were people that I know who were talking about letting, one of them was saying, I think I'm going to let, you know, my son take the public school bus to school this year. I think it would be good for him. It would give him some independence. And the other one said, I have two words for you, Eitan Pates. And that was really code. You know, everything changed when Eitan disappeared.
Yeah. Lisa Cohen, again, author of After Eitan, The Missing Child Case That Held America Captive. Lisa, do you think it's over?
I would like to think it's over. I think that would be, finally, to put this to rest after 33 years would be a wonderful thing. But I think this is all happening really fast, and there are a lot of questions to be answered. I think one of the reasons it's happening so fast is that there is, in some ways, a deadline approaching. Jose Ramos, who had been considered the prime suspect until events of this week, is due to walk free from prison in Pennsylvania on these other child molestation cases. And he's not getting parole. He is done. November 2012. And once that happens, it will be very hard to know where he is and make sure that if he is the guy, they can find him and hold on to him.
Lisa, thank you.
Thank you.
Quite something. And as we just said, for many Americans, the Eitan Pates case represents a moment in time. He helped launch missing children's movements, pictures on milk boxes, stranger danger. Well, next week, we're going to hear more about the cultural impact of this missing child movement, but also revisit another case, a 10-year-old named Andy Puglisi, who went missing in Lawrence, Massachusetts in 1976 and hadn't been seen since, which haunted his childhood friend, Melanie Perkins, so much. She herself investigated and made an award-winning documentary. We're going to speak with her next week. And we'll keep an eye on this story, of course.